Numbers, chapters 27, 28, 29, and 30. The 14th talk in a series on Numbers was presented by David Crabtree on May 19, 2019, at Reformation Fellowship. The copyright for this recording is held by David Crabtree and is being made available to you by Gutenberg College. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. Contributions to David Crabtree may be made at www.soundinterp.wordpress.com. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. Handout number 14, numbers 27, 28, 29, 30, accompanies this talk.
Okay, we're continuing our march through the book of Numbers. And today my plan is to do four chapters, starting with chapter 27. But before we launch into it, there's a little bit of unfinished business I left from last week that I want to talk about. Last week we talked about the incident at Baal Peor, in which the Israelite men, were coaxed into becoming sexually involved with the Moabite women, and then subsequently worshiping the Moabite gods. And they were judged by God for that, for what they had done. It is not clear, it isn't made clear in this section how that came to be. Why did that happen? But it becomes like just one sentence later on in Numbers that gives us a clue as to what's going on. It's in Numbers 31, verse 16. And it's just talking about the Israelites fighting against the Midianites. And remember, the Midianites are closely allied with the Moabites. And it just points out that among the people that were killed when the Israelites fought them was Balaam. Here's what the verse says. They, that is the daughters of Moab, were the ones who followed Balaam's advice and were the means of turning the Israelites away from the Lord in what happened at Peor, so that a plague struck the Lord's people. So we learn from that one sentence that Balaam was the instigator. He's the one who gave advice to the Moabites to do this, and by do this, apparently, for the women of Moab to seduce the men of Israel and to get them to worship their God. That's all it says about it, and so it's not clear exactly how this happens or why this happens, but I will give you my guess. We know that after Balaam had pronounced his seven curses, which turned out to be blessings on Israel, it says that he went to his place. And in another verse, it says that he went to his people, or he was going to his people. That would be in Mesopotamia. That would be a two-month trip there. And if you were to come back, that'd be another 2 months. We know that between the time of what happens at Baal Peor and the end of Numbers is only a few months. My suspicion is that Balaam did not end up going home. Balaam stayed. My suspicion is he stayed because he was thinking, all that money I could have had, and I didn't get it. Surely I can get it. And Therefore, he came up with the idea, I can't seem to be able to proclaim a curse. Yahweh won't let me proclaim a curse on the Israelites. But maybe I can turn Yahweh against the Israelites. Maybe I can seduce them into worshiping the Moabite God. And I'm sure Balaam understands that Yahweh is a jealous God. I'm sure that he understands that, contrary to the practice in most of the ancient world, where it was, they worshipped a lot of gods, Israel did not. Yahweh was a jealous God. And my suspicion is that Balaam then set up the Moabite women to seduce the Israelites, to make Yahweh mad at the Israelites so that a curse could be proclaimed on the Israelites. That is all my reconstruction behind one sentence. But that's the best way I can put all these pieces together. One other thing, just completely apropos to nothing, Balak, the king who had brought Balaam out from Mesopotamia to proclaim a curse on the Israelites, I read in an article just this last week that they have looked again at an inscription that they found many years ago, but they've looked at it again, and they've decided that they were misreading it before, and that it actually contains a reference to Balak of Moab, king of Moab, which is very interesting, because that would put him into the historic realm, that we have extra-biblical evidence that Balak was the king of Moab. And the inscription dates to about the time that would be appropriate. Okay, so that's the unfinished business. We're going to move on now, chapter 27. And 27, 28, 29, and 30. And as I pointed out last week, with the census that is recorded in chapter 26, we seem to have a turn in the narrative. Because before that, the narrative is all about the older generation and how they responded to God and how God responded back to them. But in the census, it tells us specifically that all of the older generation has died. Moses is the only one of the older generation that's still alive. The rest of them have all died. And I think the narrative then is taking a turn, and what we see now is giving us information about the younger generation, the newer generation. And in these chapters, there are several things that are going to come up that all have to do with plans for moving into the promised land, considerations that arise when they're thinking about moving into the promised land and receiving their allotments of land when they move in. The first one's going to be about inheritance issues. Who inherits lands? Who gets plots of lands and who inherits them? Then later on, then we'll see a passage on the passing of leadership from Moses to Joshua. And then we're going to see a passage on the offering of sacrifices and then the taking of vows. And I think that those two are related to thinking about moving into this land and becoming settled in the land and what things will be like when they do so. So I'll talk about that more at the end. Chapter 27, the first five verses. Then the daughters of Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, the son of Gilead, the son of Machir, the son of Manasseh, of the families of Manasseh, the son of Joseph, came near. And these are the names of his daughters, Mahla, Noah, and Hogla, and Milcah, and Tirzah. And they stood before Moses and before Eleazar, the priest, and before the leaders and all the congregation at the doorway of the tent of meeting, saying, Our father died in the wilderness, yet he was not among the company of those who gathered themselves together against the Lord in the company of Korah. but he died in his own sin, and he had no sons. Why should the name of our father be withdrawn from among his family because he had no son? Give us a possession among our father's brothers. And Moses brought their case before the Lord. Here we have the daughters of Zelophehad. They were, if you will recall, they were mentioned in the census. That was one of the little excursies that was in the text of the census. That in chapter 26, verse 33, it says, "Now Zelophehad, the son of Hepher, had no sons, but only daughters." And it goes on and it gives their names. So that's kind of a foreshadowing of this incident that we're reading in chapter 27. And the problem is, their father, Zelophehad, had only daughters. He had no sons. And if he has no sons, then no one will inherit. And they know that they're going into the land. They will all be getting portions of land. And so these daughters, all from the son of Zelophehad, his representatives, they will get no portion of land assigned to them. So that's the concern that they are bringing to Moses. They bring it to Moses and Eleazar and the whole assembly before the tent of meeting. So it's a very public thing. And the argument that they're making is, our father died in the wilderness. So he was one of the older generation. He's died, but he was not involved in the Korah rebellion, which apparently is a big deal. I mean, we've noticed that it seemed to have been a big deal, and here's more evidence. It was indeed a big deal, that was an outrageous rebellion against God. He was not involved in that, but he died in his own sin. So he's not blameless. He wasn't blameless when he died, but he was not involved in that particular rebellion. And he had no sons. So why should his name not be allowed to go on? Why should he not have an allotment in the land? So that's the case that they have made. They bring that to Moses, and Moses then takes that to God. Verse 6. Then the Lord spoke to Moses, saying, "The daughters of Zelophehad are right in their statements. You shall surely give them a hereditary possession among their father's brothers, and you shall transfer the inheritance of their father to them. Further, you shall speak to the sons of Israel, saying, 'If a man dies and has no son, then you shall transfer his inheritance to his daughter. And if he has no daughter, then you shall give his inheritance to his brothers. And if he has no brother, then you shall give his inheritance to his father's brothers. And if his father has no brothers, then you shall give his inheritance to his nearest relatives in his own family. And he shall possess it, and it shall be a statutory ordinance to the sons of Israel, just as the Lord commanded Moses.'" So Moses brings this to God, and God says, they're right. There does need to be an amendment to the law. This isn't the first amendment that we've seen to the law that was given to the Israelites at Mount Sinai. We've seen several of them in the book of Numbers. But there are several instances where the law has either been added to or there's some issue that's been clarified. And this is just another one of those. And the clarification is, in this case where there are no sons to inherit, then the inheritance goes to you shall transfer his inheritance to his daughter. And if he has no daughter, so it goes on further, not just this instance, but if he has no daughter, then it goes to his brothers. So that would be the daughter's uncles. And if he has no brothers, then it goes to his father's brothers. And if there are no father's brothers, then it goes to the nearest relative. So that is all going to become part of the law then that has been passed down from God to Moses that the Israelites are obligated to keep. just notice that, well, there are a couple things here that are of interest, I think. One, that foreshadowing, that little excursus that was buried in the census that foreshadows this, talking about this incident, suggests that Numbers is a carefully constructed book. And we've seen, I think, evidence of that before as well. The second thing, the Israelites are thinking about the settlement of the land. These daughters are thinking about going into the land, and the land is going to be divided up among the Israelites. And because they're thinking about it, there are issues that are arising that otherwise would not have arisen. And this passage, third thing, this passage suggests a procedure by which the law could be amended. That is, the daughters brought this concern to Moses, and Moses took that concern to God. And the law was indeed amended accordingly. And that suggests that the law was not a perfect and complete set of laws that were given to the Israelites. It's something that over time is amended and added to. Then there's a question, why is this section here? And there's a quote from Wenham, who actually is quoting from Calvin, that I thought was helpful. He says, Calvin's suggestion has much to commend it. The request of Zelophehad's daughters showed their faith in the divine promises. Moses arranged another census to make sure the as yet unconquered land would be divided equitably among the tribes. They respond by requesting a portion in that land, thereby demonstrating that they have no truck with the unbelief that damned their father's generation. Because of their piety, their action is recorded for posterity. So they fully expect to go into the land. They think it's going to happen, unlike the previous generation that thought it was impossible. Verse 12. Then the Lord said to Moses, go up to this mountain of Abarim and see the land which I have given to the sons of Israel. And when you have seen it, you too shall be gathered to your people, as Aaron your brother was. For in the wilderness of Zin, during the strife of the congregation, you rebelled against my command to treat me as holy before their eyes at the water. These are the waters of Meribah of Kadesh in the wilderness of Zin. So it's getting, God is preparing Moses now for the time when he will die. He won't actually die in Numbers. He will die at the end of Deuteronomy. So it's many pages from now. It's just not very many months from now. And God says that he's going to go up on the Mount of Abarim. From that vantage point, he will be able to see the promised land. So Moses is going to be allowed to see it, but he won't be able to enter into it. And on that mountain then, Moses will die, and he will be gathered up. He says, you too shall be gathered up to your people as Aaron your brother was. So he's going to die and be taken up just as Aaron was. And then it gives the reason, and the reason is because of his rebelliousness at Meribah, and we've talked about that before, when he was told to speak to the rock, and he struck the rock. Okay. When I was looking at this paragraph this week, I was reading it and thinking about it, and I teared up. Moses is an amazing character, and yet it's just sad to see him go, period. It is interesting that it does not say in Numbers as much as it says in Deuteronomy. Deuteronomy 3:23 through 26, Moses describes that last conversation, that conversation that he had with Yahweh, when Yahweh said that he prepared him to die. Deuteronomy 3:23. In Deuteronomy, Moses says, I also pleaded with the Lord at that time, saying, O Lord God, thou hast begun to show thy servant thy greatness and thy strong hand. For what God is there in heaven or on earth who can do such works and mighty acts as thine? Let me, I pray, cross over and see the fair land that is beyond the Jordan, that good hill country and Lebanon. But the Lord was angry with me on your account and would not listen to me. And the Lord said to me, enough, speak to me no more of this matter. So God was not going to countenance any more objections. He was not going to be allowed to go into the land. Verse 15. Then Moses spoke to the Lord, saying, May the Lord, the God of the spirits of all flesh, appoint a man over the congregation who will go out and come in before them, and who will lead them out and bring them in, that the congregation of the Lord may not be like sheep which have no shepherd. So the Lord said to Moses, Take Joshua the son of Nun, a man in whom is the Spirit, and lay your hand on him, and have him stand before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation, and commission him in their sight. And you shall put some of your authority on him in order that all the congregation of the sons of Israel may obey him. Moreover, he shall stand before Eleazar the priest, who shall inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim before the Lord. At this command they shall go out, and at his command they shall come in, both he and the sons of Israel with him, even all the congregation. And Moses did just as the Lord commanded him, and he took Joshua and set him before Eleazar the priest and before all the congregation. Then he laid his hands on him and commissioned him, just as the Lord had spoken through Moses. So Moses requests that there be someone appointed to provide leadership for the Israelites. And that is good. God sees that as a wise thing to happen and instructs Moses what to do. Moses, God says to take Joshua. Joshua has been Moses' right-hand man ever since, well, we know since Mount Sinai at the very latest. And Joshua has been very loyal and faithful to Moses throughout that time period. And that's the one who is designated then to take over for Moses. And it's a man in whom is the Spirit, is the way that God describes it. And Moses then is supposed to commission him before all the people at the tabernacle. And I find that interesting because we have seen that since the Korah rebellion, there are a lot of things that have been done in public sight, unmediated. Whereas before that, Moses went up to Mount Sinai and entered into a cloud. And part of Korah's rebellion seemed to be that they distrusted Moses being a fair broker as a mediator between them and God. So God takes steps to do things in a way that is less mediated. God does things more directly. And in this case, Joshua is commissioned in the sight of everyone by Moses. Eleazar is also supposed to be present. So the high priest is going to be present. And he is the one then who will inquire for him by the judgment of the Urim. This is the Urim and Thummim, which nobody knows exactly what it is, but there are apparently two tokens. And people's best guess is that one token was colored with, one side of the token is colored with one color, say red. The other one is, the other side is green, and both of them are so colored. And then those are thrown kind of like dice or something, or flipped like a coin or whatever. If they come down the same color, then it's a yes. If they turn out different colors, then it's a no. The Urim and Thummim can only return a yes or a no. And it's only done by the high priest, inquiring of the Lord. Well, Eleazar has the Urim and Thummim, so he will be the one who will take Joshua's requests. When Joshua wants to inquire of the Lord, he will go to Eleazar, and Eleazar will use the Urim and Thummim to get the answer. And then it says that Moses is supposed to put some of your authority on him. Some of your authority on him. That's an interesting phrase. And it's curious what exactly that means. There are some who argue that Joshua is being presented here as one who has less authority than Moses did. He is a step down. Moses was a more authoritative and more powerful figure than is Joshua. Moses had been given more power by God than Joshua. I'm not sure that that's exactly the case, but it is true that Moses spoke to God face to face, and that is changing. Joshua does not speak to God face to face. Joshua goes to Eleazar, who casts the Urim and Thummim. It says here that he has only some of Moses' authority. My suspicion is that what that means is that they were co-leaders until Moses dies. So I don't think it means that Joshua was given less authority than Moses had in the final analysis. But it is curious that it says that Moses is to give some of his authority to Joshua. There is something that's happening here. There is a difference between Joshua and Moses. It looks like there is a sharper distinction between high priest and king that's developing here. Moses was the leader. His brother Aaron was the high priest, at least nominally. But in many respects, Moses played the role of high priest as well. Now we're going to have a much sharper distinction. Joshua is not playing the role of high priest at all. Eleazar is the high priest. And Joshua is not a prophet like Moses was. Joshua does not speak to God face to face like Moses did. So there is something happening here that's different. Then God says the people will do as he, that is Joshua, commands. Joshua is going to be given an authority that will be recognized by the people of Israel. Remember what a struggle it was for Moses to gain legitimacy in the sight of his fellow Israelites. That was a lifelong struggle for him. For Joshua, that will not be a struggle. Joshua is going to be able to stand on the shoulders of Moses. Moses has established that position, and Joshua is stepping into that position and will not have the same struggle that Moses did. Okay, chapters 28 and 29 are going to be listing the burnt offerings that are to be offered by the Israelites when they get into the land. This waits until they get into the land. But they're going to be offering a lot of whole burnt offerings. These two chapters are quite repetitive, and as a result, I will not read through them. But I think the repetition is important. If you'll remember in Exodus, they were preparing to build the tabernacle, and leaders from each tribe brought gifts that they were going to be used in conjunction with the tabernacle. And in the text of Exodus, it goes through and it tells us each leader and what they brought. And it is highly repetitive. Highly repetitive. And I made the point at the time that it is so repetitive that I'm convinced that in the ancient world, they reveled in that repetition. They delighted in it. There was something about that repetition that they actually enjoyed. And I think that what they enjoyed was sensing the excitement and the generosity that was behind all of those gifts. They're kind of reliving, vicariously experiencing all of that excitement and wanting to be a part, wanting to do their part with respect to the tabernacle. So the repetition drives home the magnitude of something. I was trying to think of a good example. For what happens in Exodus, my example was a military parade. Highly repetitive. You see soldiers marching by, a tank goes by, I haven't been to a military parade recently, but all this armament goes by, but it's highly repetitive. What is the point of it? It's all that repetition tells you we've got a lot of power here. In this case, what is magnified is how many sacrifices are being given. There are a lot of them. And I think that we are supposed to delight in the fact that there are a lot of them. And these sacrifices are a way for the people to express their humility and gratitude towards God. All of the sacrifices that are listed are whole burnt offerings. There were other kinds of offerings that they gave. There are other kinds of sacrifices that they gave. But this is just a list of the whole burnt offerings. In a whole burnt offering, the entire animal is burned up. The priests don't eat any of it. The people don't eat any of it. This is a list of the things that the whole burnt offerings symbolize, according to Dennis Cole, one of the commentators that I looked at. He says there are five things. Number one, a total burnt offering is a method by which the physical sacrifice is rendered fully to the Lord. The visible is rendered into the world of the invisible, and the smoke enters symbolically the nostrils of God with a sweet aroma such that he is pleased. Two, the animal must be perfect and unblemished because God requires nothing short of absolute purity. Three, nothing is returned to the offerer, signifying God's complete ownership. Fourth, offerings are made publicly as expressions of faith and obedience by those who must be ritually pure before the presentation of the object. And fifth, blood, the symbol of the life of the sacrifice, was poured out on the altar as a means of returning life to the giver of all life. And Cole says, some were expiatory or propitiatory in nature, effecting atonement for the offerer, while others were celebrative, honoring God for the blessings of life. So this gives, then, a listing of all of the whole burnt offerings that the people of Israel were required to give. It starts out by giving the offerings that are supposed to, that are given on a daily basis. There's one offering in the morning and one offering at twilight. And in those offerings, there is one lamb offered in each offering. So one lamb in the morning, one lamb in the evening. With the lamb, a tenth of an ephah of flour, and that's approximately 10 cups of flour, and that is mixed with about 1.5 quarts of oil, and the text specifies that that oil is from olives that have been beaten rather than pressed, and I have no idea why that's significant. Most oil back then was produced by weights pressing the oil out, but this is oil from beaten olives. And a fourth of a hin of strong drink libation is also to be poured out each time. And again, that's about a quart and a half. So one time in the morning, the sacrifice is given. One time at twilight, the sacrifice is given. That is repeated 365 days a year. Every day, that one is given. That's a lot of lambs. And that's just the start. And it needs to be of the finest quality, and it's offered in a holy place, that is, on the altar in front of the tabernacle. The next offerings, every Saturday then, there are other offerings that are given in addition to the daily offerings. The offerings that are given on Sabbath consist of two rams, 2/10 of an ephah of flour per ram, so that's about 20 cups of flour per ram. Then the libation. Oh, and that flour presumably is mixed with oil. I think that was true of all of these, even though it doesn't always state that. Okay, so every Saturday then, in addition to the daily offerings, we have two more rams that are offered. And as I understand it, these were offered right after the morning offering of the daily offerings. Then, the first day of every month, there is another offering, and that's called the New Moon Festival. So 12 times a year, this offering, this special offering is given. It consists of two bowls, with 3/10 of an ephah of flour mixed in with oil, and half a hin of wine per bull. So two bulls, one ram with 2/10 of an ephah of flour mixed with oil, and 1/3 of a hin of wine, and seven lambs with 1/10 of an ephah of flour mixed with oil per lamb, plus 1/4 of a hin of wine per lamb. And one goat as a sin offering, and that goat is offered up with a libation as well. So that's in addition to the daily offerings, and if it were to happen on a Sabbath, in addition to the Sabbath offerings. No, this is for the whole nation. This is for the whole nation being offered at the tabernacle. Okay, now the offerings that are given on for the New Moon Festival, that same recipe is used for the holidays. So I will not go through what all of the text does, but I am not going to go through that same recipe for each holiday. Just know that for each holiday, and on the holidays that are multiple days, held over multiple days, that same recipe is used each day. So then it's going to go through the holidays in the order that they're listed in Exodus. Starts with the Passover. And in the Passover, then the first day, it's that same recipe that is used for the new moon festival. And those sacrifices are repeated every day for the rest of the feast, so it's for 8 days total. And that's in addition to the daily offerings, as well as the Sabbath offerings when they occur. And for the Passover holiday, it is a Sabbath on the first day of Passover and the last day of Passover. Now, when it says that this is a Sabbath, this is a Sabbath with no laborious work. This is a less strict Sabbath than the weekly Sabbath. And I tried to look to see what the technical term is for this kind of Sabbath, but I couldn't find it. But this is more is allowed on these Sabbaths than there is on the weekly Sabbath, more activity. But there is a Sabbath at the beginning of Passover and a Sabbath at the end of Passover. You can have a situation where you've got several Sabbaths together, and that makes for a long 2 or 3 days if you're in Israel, because you can't do much on those days and it's hard to get food. Okay, so that's Passover. So that's in April, March, sometime in that area. The next one is Shavuot, or the Feast of Weeks, or Pentecost, and that's in late June, early July. The same recipe of burnt offerings then is to be given on Shavuot as on the New Moon Festival, in addition to the daily offerings. And again, that is a Sabbath. Then in the fall, in the seventh month, the Feast of Trumpets. It says that is a day for blowing trumpets. And the same recipe is used for that holiday, in addition to the daily offerings. And this is on the first of the month, so it's also in addition to the new moon offerings. Then there's the offering on the Day of Atonement, which comes just a few days later. And that's a day on which you shall humble yourselves, it says. The same recipe is used. And the daily offerings are also given. And that this is a Sabbath. Then the last holiday of the year, Sukkot, which comes just a few days after the Day of Atonement, Yom Kippur. Sukkot is the Feast of Tabernacles. It lasts for 8 days, and it tells you in the text, it gives the list of what needs to be offered on each day. But the offerings are almost the same for each day. The only thing that changes is the number of bulls that are offered. And this recipe is the same as the other holidays, except that instead of 7 lambs, it's 14 lambs that are offered. And on day one, the number of bulls is 13. And this is a Sabbath. And these are all offered in addition to the daily offerings. On day two, it's the same things are offered as day one, except it's one less bull. It's 12 bulls instead of 13. The third day of Sukkot, it's the same, except there are 11 bulls offered. The fourth day of Sukkot, it's the same, except there are 10 bulls offered. On day five, it's the same, except there are 9 bulls offered. On day six, it's the same, except 8 bulls offered. On day seven, it's the same, except 7 bulls offered. And then day eight, it's the same, except there is only 1 bull. It's actually different. 1 bull offered, 1 ram, and 7 lambs, and 1 goat as a sin offering on the last day of Sukkot, which is also a Sabbath. Okay. So that's essentially the content of those two chapters, chapters 28 and 29. chapter 30. This now turns to vows, and there are some things that are clarified with respect to vows, and in particular, it's vows taken by women who are under authority. And it's going to look at four different instances. I'll read the first one. Then Moses spoke to the heads of the tribes of the sons of Israel, saying, "This is the word which the Lord has commanded. If a man makes a vow to the Lord, or takes an oath to bind himself with a binding obligation, he shall not violate his word. He shall do according to all that proceeds out of his mouth. Also, if a woman makes a vow to the Lord and binds herself by an obligation in her father's house in her youth, and her father hears her vow and her obligation by which she has bound herself, and her father says nothing to her, then all her vows shall stand, and every obligation by which she has bound herself shall stand. But if her father should forbid her on the day he hears of it, none of her vows or her obligations by which she has bound herself shall stand, and the Lord will forgive her because her father has forbidden it." The first thing to note is that there is an emphasis placed on the fact that if you make a vow, you are obligated to fulfill it. That's true for everybody. Vows are to be taken seriously. The vows that are being talked about in this chapter, there is one word used for the vows, and it's used throughout the passage until we get to the very end. And there a different word is used. The word that is used in most of this passage refers to positive vows. That is, I promise to do X. The word at the very end is a negative vow. I promise not to do X. And usually the not to do X is it's vowing to fast. I vow not to eat for this day. Ashley says, the practice of making promises or vows to God seems ancient, both in Israel and in the rest of the ancient Near East. Vows may be positive promises to do or perform something, or they may be negative promises to abstain from something. In general, the Hebrew word that encompasses both kinds of promises is neder. The present text uses neder only to express the positive vow. The negative vow is expressed uniquely in chapter 30 by Issachar, and that's at the end. The first instance talks about a young woman who makes a vow when she's in her father's house. She's apparently a young, unmarried woman. And what it's saying is her father has veto power over that vow. If her father doesn't like that vow for some reason, whatever reason, he can nullify that vow and she is not obligated to fulfill it. If, however, he doesn't say anything about it, he doesn't nullify it, then it is binding and she must fulfill it. Verse 6. However, if she should marry while under her vows, or the rash statement of her lips by which she has bound herself, and her husband hears of it and says nothing to her on the day he hears it, then her vows shall stand and her obligations by which she has bound herself shall stand. But if on the day her husband hears of it, he forbids her, then he shall annul her vow which she is under and the rash statement of her lips by which she has bound herself, and the Lord will forgive her. This is apparently referring to a woman who is engaged to get married. And the issue is, who has what? Who has the authority to nullify that? And it's the one to whom she's engaged, then, is the one that can nullify it if he chooses to do so. But if he doesn't nullify it, then that vow stands. The third situation in verse 9, But the vow of a widow or of a divorced woman, everything by which she has bound herself shall stand against her. So she's widowed or divorced, and she takes a vow, then no one can override that. That vow is in force. Then the last one is a woman who is married, verse 10. However, if she vowed in her husband's house or bound herself by an obligation with an oath, and her husband heard it but said nothing to her and did not forbid her, then all her vows shall stand, and every obligation by which she bound herself shall stand. But if her husband indeed annuls them on the day he hears them, then whatever proceeds out of her lips concerning her vows or concerning the obligation of herself shall not stand. Her husband has annulled them, and the Lord will forgive her. So again, her husband is the one who can nullify this, and if he does so, then it's nullified. If he doesn't, then she is obligated by it. Verse 13, then, is if she takes a vow to not do something. Every vow and every binding oath to humble one's herself, her husband may confirm it or her husband may annul it. But if her husband indeed says nothing to her from day to day, then he confirms all her vows or all her obligations which are on her. He has confirmed them because he said nothing to her on the day he heard them. But if he indeed annuls them after he has heard them, then he shall bear her guilt. Then verse 16, summing it up, these are the statutes which the Lord commanded Moses as between a man and his wife, and as between a father and his daughter, while she is in her youth in her father's house. Okay. How do these chapters, these four chapters, how do they fit together? The first one had to do with inheritance. And that came up, that issue came up as a demonstration of the faith of these daughters of Zelophehad. They are confident that they will take the land. And the older generation died in the wilderness because they were afraid and refused to go into the land. So this little incident is giving us just a glimpse into the character of this newer generation. They believe that they will be moving into the land. The second, the appointment of Joshua. Here we have an official passing of the baton. A new generation is taking over power. Then we have the offerings. Once in the land, they will need to establish the worship, the cult of the tabernacle. Milgram says, thus, Israel's first duty upon settling in the land, in its land, is to establish the proper lines of communion with the Lord through the medium of his cult. And when I use the word cult, that's what it just means, their religious practices. Why the emphasis on the numbers of offerings that are to be given? First of all, it assumes prosperity. That's a lot of lambs. That's a lot of bulls. They would have to be doing well in the land in order to give all of these animals as sacrifices. And secondly, it's a way of taking delight in their relationship to God. We get to offer all of these animals as sacrifices humbly and gratefully to our God. And we are doing what he has asked us to do, and it represents a relationship that we have with God. So it's a very positive thing. And then the vows. The vows express devotion to God. Ashley says, the reason for the nature of the Pentateuchal laws may be that the Israelites assumed, with much of the culture around them, that vows were a legitimate expression of devotion to one's God. Hence, only specific ordinances governing the vows were seen as necessary. That it was a cultural response to God as a way of expressing your devotion to God, taking vows. And as such, there were certain statutes given with respect to the giving of vows. So this passage anticipates an uptick in expressions of devotion to God, out of gratitude to God for giving them the land. I think this also plays another role in Numbers, this passage. The emphasis placed on the need to fulfill your vows, fulfill your promises to God. If people need to keep their vows, God will certainly keep his vows. And in the next book, in Deuteronomy, God and the Israelites are going to ratify their covenant, which is essentially promises or vows that are being taken both by God and the Israelites with respect to the terms of that covenant. Those vows must be kept. God is obligated to keep his end of the deal, and he will. And the people are obligated to keep their end of the deal. So I think these four parts of the chapters that we looked at, they are all suggesting that we have made a turn here and that there is something positive that's happening in this second generation. This younger generation is now taking over control, leadership, the older ones having died. And in every way that they are taking over, it seems to be marked by their faithfulness to God in contrast to their parents. They saw what God did to set them free from Egypt, and that had a big impact on them. My wife and I were just reading at the end of Joshua this last week, and it's relevant to what we're looking at here. It talks about the death of Joshua. This is Joshua 24, 29 through 31. After these things, Joshua, son of Nun, the servant of the Lord, died at the age of 110, and they buried him in the land of his inheritance at Timnah-Serah in the hill country of Ephraim, north of Mount Gaash. Israel served the Lord throughout the lifetime of Joshua and of the elders who outlived him and who had experienced everything the Lord had done for Israel. So that suggests that this younger generation, they come along and there is a different spirit at work among them. There is a faithfulness, a gratitude, and a loyalty to God that was not clear in the older generation. But as we went through Numbers, there are, I think, signs that towards the end of the older generation's lives, there was something happening, something positive happening. But we see it manifesting itself more fully in the next generation, in the younger generation. And they look back at what happened in Egypt, and for them, that was really striking. They remember that, and then they're going to remember what God does as he moves them into the Holy Land. And they respond to God with great gratitude. So I think we're seeing a really positive turn here, and it's interesting and I think encouraging, because it seems to me that typically what we see is a degradation over time from one generation to the next, but that apparently is not always the case. That you can have a generation come along that responds very differently and more positively to God. But my suspicion is that it was the older generation in their later years that kind of set the tone for what happens in the younger generation, if I'm reading it correctly. Okay, questions, comments?
David, Jack has said that if you live during in the Old Testament time with these sacrifices, you should be able to have realized that there was something down the line that was going to replace that or basically replace that. And I always thought that, I'm not so sure I could have thought that. I mean, I don't know. But when you were explaining how pervasive these sacrifices were in everyday life, I'm not so sure that I would have asked, can this go on forever, or what's really the purpose behind all of this? And so my question basically is, if I was a Jew living during this time, what should be my attitude towards these sacrifices? I mean, you touched a little bit on that, but I'm assuming that the sacrifices were done in one locale.
Yes.
And so if I lived out in the boonies away from that, how was I aware of those? How was I participating in them? I'm assuming that in some way the different tribes or whatever provided the livestock or whatever for the sacrifices. But mm-hmm. I don't know if you can just comment. I mean, if we were Jewish guys during that time, how would we look at that, or what were we supposed to be thinking?
Yeah, that's a good question. Had I lived at the time, I'm not sure what I would have understood, because I'm not smart enough. But as time goes on, it becomes clearer and clearer, I think. And part of the clarity comes from, you've got priests who are not living lives that exemplify holiness, and you've got there's a lot of wickedness that's clearly evident, and they're offering these sacrifices, and what can they possibly mean when they're being offered in a spirit that can't possibly be what was intended? So it does become clear later on, certainly by the time you get to Isaiah, he's saying, what good are these sacrifices? And it's not because the sacrifices in and of themselves are wrong, are bad, but they are not accompanied by the spirit that was intended to be behind them. My sense is that in this particular generation, you have the right spirit that's accompanying them, and that's what God is really interested in. And someone who is really perceptive at the time, I think, would be able to realize that that spirit has to be there. I think it's really interesting as we go through Exodus and Numbers. They are not accused of not carrying out the rituals correctly. None of them. In every case, it's a lack of gratitude, or it's grumbling, or whatever. It is lacking an act that lacks the gratitude and humility that's required by God. And I think any perceptive person at this time would have recognized that gratitude and humility has to come along with the sacrifices. And at some point in history, they realize, you know, we don't even have to have the sacrifices. But the gratitude and humility is what God really wants. But how soon, how perceptive would you have to be at this time to pick up on that? I'm not sure. But I do think they should have recognized that humility and gratitude had to come with the sacrifices.
I'm trying to figure out what kind of vow you're talking about. I know it's a vow to God, but if it's a vow that a father or a husband or can take away, can you explain what kind of vow that might be?
Well, I'm just assuming it would be there are a few examples we see in the Old Testament where someone would take a vow, where I will do X or I will not do X as a way of expressing to you, God, my desire that this thing happen. Whatever it is, that it rain, that we have rain on our crops. I will do X as a way of expressing to you, God, that I really want it to rain. Or I will not eat for a day to express to you, God, that I really want it to rain. It's that kind of thing.
Okay. I'm just wondering, you're talking about a change between the older and the newer generation, and I'm looking back at chapter 21, and one, of course, the older and newer generation, I mean, there's definitely a what do you call it, overlap,
right,
for sure.
Right.
But in chapter 21, with the issue with the bronze snake, and,
yes,
and they say then, why have you brought us out of Egypt to die in the desert? There's no bread and there's no water. So this is still the older generation that's saying this, not the new. I kind of understood, right, when we did this, it was kind of part of this newer generation that was coming up.
Right. I think that the way the book of Numbers is structured is that we are to understand everything that happens up to the census as being on the shoulders of the older generation.
Okay.
If we were to look at it demographically, there is a transition that's taking,
yeah,
place.
For sure.
And my suspicion is at Baal Peor, it was younger generation Israelite males that were having sex with Moabite women.
The younger generation.
Yeah.
Okay, yeah.
But somehow for the narrative of Numbers, it is up until the census, we're supposed to see that as being representative of the older generation, even though I'm sure there are younger people that are participating in the wrongdoing.
Mm-hmm. So then they must have had a realization that things needed to change or something.
Well, I think we're talking about both the older generation and the younger generation as a generalization. And that I'm sure there were bad eggs in the younger generation. But as a whole, they could be characterized, I think, especially if we look at that passage in Joshua,
yeah,
they were people who were following God. And that, you mentioned the incident with the serpent. That's when, as when we were going through that section, I pointed out, that's the only time they said, we have sinned.
Mm.
So there, something happens there.
Yeah. Right.
That's different. And I think that's indicative of the older generation. Something clicked towards the end of their lives. And that's what sets the stage for the younger generation.
So just a really quick question. So Jews of this thinking, Jews today, do they make sacrifices today?
No.
So when did that all cross over or go away?
When the temple was destroyed.
Okay.
The second time.
Okay.
Well, it stopped when the first temple was destroyed also, but they restarted when they had built the second temple.
Right.
And then that continued until the second temple was destroyed.
Okay.
And so that becomes, for Jews, that's a real problem. We're supposed to be, that's the God-given way of dealing with our sins and our relationship with God, and we can't do it.
Mm-hmm. Thanks, David.
Do you know if there are any modern day, I mean, did they replace it with something? Are there rituals that are to replace the sacrifices, do they do? Or since they can't do the sacrifices at the temple?
Well, the short answer is no. There's nothing else that can be done.
I'm pleasantly surprised by how much I've enjoyed going through Numbers so far.
Thank you.
And it really helps to have it illustrated and have someone like you who takes the time to think about it. Weird question, though. It seems to me I'm seeing a lot of illustrations about God is like this. And then I see a bunch of illustrations that say the people are like this. And it just keeps recurring over and over. No, God is like this.
Yep.
But the people are like that.
Yep.
And I'm wondering if they're really having, if part of that is their inability to break away from the pagan model of their relationship to their God. And this is where it hit me while you were talking. God manifests thunder, lightning, smoke, and this big booming voice. And Moses goes up and meets with him. God comes down and shows his presence by this big cloud that emanates light. And then when it leaves, Moses comes down and says, hey, I've been talking to God. And they have the, it's crazy to me to think that they're going to step up and say, Moses, we don't think you're telling us the truth. This isn't what God told you. Mm-hmm. As if God is no longer there to hear what Moses told them and wouldn't be aware of it.
Right.
But that is a really strange dynamic.
Right.
So what's going on there?
Right.
Is did their gods come and go? Did they have no ears for a while? And then they came back and say, hey, what you been doing while I was gone? What's up with that?
I don't know for sure. My sense is that their vision of the ancient gods was that they were more localized. That is, they were in a place. And they may move to another place, but they're only in one place at any one time. And they could kind of come and go and be interested and then distracted, etc. And that's a great observation. I think that is right. I think that's part of their difficulty is understanding what kind of a God this is that they're dealing with. And that's part of what is happening in the wilderness is this is a curriculum where they're learning what kind of God this is that they are having to deal with. And being human beings, they are slow learners. Just one more.
One more, all right. Yeah, thanks, David. This is really great. Do you see in this section dealing with Joshua and his appointment, and then following that up with all of the sacrifices and rituals, a type or foreshadow of Christ? Is that at a other church that would be the preaching would launch right into that, and that's what the whole service would be about? I'm just curious what you make of that. Is that something that we're to intentionally notice? Is there I can't remember. Does New Testament authors key in on any of these passages in relation to that?
Yeah, I don't know if any of them do. I know that that is what's typically done. I haven't figured this stuff out yet, so I don't know exactly how we are supposed to look at the Old Testament vis-a-vis the New Testament. So my project right now is to immerse myself in the Old Testament passage. What is the Old Testament passage saying? What can we get from that? And I think then if the better handle I can get on that, the better prepared I'll be then to figure out, okay, how does this relate to the New Testament? So that's part of my project, and I'm not to the place where I feel confident talking about types and foreshadowing and stuff in those technical terms. Okay, thank you very much.